Right, so welcome everybody. Welcome Mark and Bonnie. We're here to have a conversation, which is sort of a follow-up of different conversations we've had. We met in the wilds of Vermont in the summertime at a symposium of sorts. And I wanted to start by asking one question to both of you. In one of Bonnie's communications, she said that, I believe there's something new is being asked of us here. And so I want to know what that something new. I want to jump right in and say, what is this something new that is being asked of us?
I'll just start with one phrase, and then hopefully Mark, you can riff off of it, and then me, because what just came to my mind was a greater reality.
A greater reality. A greater reality. Yes, and it's what comes to my mind first, Bonnie and Andrew, and thank you for hosting and creating this space. And what comes to my mind is actually I start very personal. Mm-hmm. Right, we're at a as Andrew called it, a symposium of sorts, right? At a Surya's place, you know, at the monastery, which is in the hood here. I think Vermont is becoming very much the hood. I don't know how that happened, right? You know, we have Brendan's place here, the center's here, and the monastery is there. So Vermont is happening. And, you know, we had Bonnie, we had never met. We knew, I think, kind of vaguely of each other, you know, because we overlap at least in some circles. And we had a kind of an intense, deep meeting. And, you know, the seminar was about cosmorotic humanism, and it was convened by Zach and myself. And, you know, one of the questions that we were talking about, that Zach and I were talking about afterwards, is how do we create the kind of the intimate communion between the few of us in the world that are involved in that famous Teilhard quote, you know, the sensual longing for communion with those, you know, in this process of trying to articulate a new language. And in some sense, that kind of communion that could come out of the seminar, you know, and I enjoyed a walk with you, Bonnie, and we got to talk a little bit more and to chat a little bit more, and to kind of come out the other side and to kind of have that as a ground for deepening seems to be important, although that seems like a very intimate personal thing to say, and it is, but it actually seems in my body, heart, mind, so essential for the greater reality, you know. And maybe with this to pass back to you, there's a text in a tractate Sanhedrin in the 3rd century in the Talmud where they're describing the end of days, you know, and the end of days, you know, in the way I understand them, are an analog in the interior sciences. I call them the interior sciences or the great traditions for existential risk. Sometimes it's the language of interior sciences for existential risk. And the description is that in the end of days, right, the way that things will go will be dependent on the nature of the relationship between teachers. Right? Will teachers essentially, they say, murder each other, right? Or will teachers love each other? But love each other, they mean not in a flaccid way, not in a kind of, you know, leveling of differences way, but to be able to really create intimate communion is everything. And, you know, so the depth of, you know, exchange and our capacity to have a conversation and a conversational cosmos where clearly conversations don't know how to be had. You know, witness, right, the Middle East, which is breaking all of our hearts now. Just to be able to have a deep conversation, you know, when we share so much in common, right? And when you think about the billions of people on the planet, right, we're in this little right? And to be able to then, you know, learn from each other and fructify and then create a larger whole. And this field of Eros seems to be so wildly essential that almost like everything depends on it. Something like that, Andrew. Just Bonnie, just you asked to start and I pass for the riff of, if that's an okay start.
Yeah. No, this is great. I mean, I think the greater reality is this confluence of teachers or people who take seriously existential risk. I mean, there are many different perspectives on it. And a lot of the conversation around meta crisis and stuff is, or perma crisis, some of it is serious, but not at a level of depth. Where I know that a couple of times at the symposium, I prefaced what I was going to say, and a lot of it was not directed directly to you, but preface it by saying, if we take that this is really a time between worlds, that is a radical challenge that we're facing then, because if you're not in that context, then a lot of the things we're talking about are not practical. And we're not always in that context, right? So this greater reality somehow contextualizes this inferno, let's say, okay, this inferno. And I think both, so that's one thing. And I recognize we're both trying to contextualize the inferno. So that's one thing. And what I want to say is that a couple of things, and this that might lead into the actual question and it may go somewhere else, but it's like when I think about why you and I are in this together, I can blame Ken. Ken, you're to blame.
Ken Wilber, by the way, for
that called it the integral diaspora. I think it's, you know, we've all were compressed and then we all moved out and became seeds, right? The seed had blew open and some people saw that as a failure. And actually people went and seeded a lot of new initiatives. So that's one reason why we're in the same context, same thing. The second is because during that compression, we became a community in some ways without knowing it. And then when you reconnect with people, you find, oh, I'm still connected with this person by some kind of thread I didn't know was there. And that wasn't so much between you and I, but you and common people, right?
Right.
But I think the third thing is that the needs of people, the needs of our students, let's just call them students, they have constellated us. So it's like a both and, like we are seeds that ripple out teachings. But if I'm honest with myself, it's watching what is in the next generation or the 20-year-olds to 40 to 50-year-olds, I have to be honest that they are constellating me also. The world obviously is, the risk is constellating us. And so for me, that was kind of what I was probably very unskillfully trying to bring to the table in what I saw otherwise was kind of a more linear approach versus, and so, you know, we talked about, I think both approaches should be in the mix. But yeah, that's so yeah. To me that, yeah.
So the approaches are something, just for me to frame it a little bit, between lineage, let's say, and hierarchy of lineages and value hierarchies of lineage, And then the more organic kind of emerging communities that arise as it seemed like there was a sort of a tension I'm not sure what you really disagreed with exactly precisely, or if you even did disagree, but there's a tension in sort of approach or
yeah, I think be careful because okay. it's not, I don't have a postmodern allergy to hierarchies. I have a, I can contextualize that. That's, and I, it's not, you know, we have to be careful that we're not looking at the common dualities that people fall into. We're trying to search for exactly what it is that was not syncing. Yeah.
I mean, maybe, you know, you invoked, you know, my dear friend and, you know, our colleague, Ken. So first off, just it's lovely to invoke him. I miss Ken. And Ken and I met in 2003. That's where the conversations began. And we began a fierce set, and it's directly related to this conversation. Mm-hmm. We began a fierce set of contestations in a certain sense between us about what we later came to call the second person of the divine. You know, Ken had written Up from Eden, a very kind of first person and third person, had excluded the second person. And we did a very deep dive at that time. And all sorts of things emerged from those conversations, which shaped kind of a number of chapters in the integral world. At a certain point, Ken and I started a think tank, the center. And, you know, Zach joined Stein, you know, like 2011 as academic director. And maybe that contact is good for this conversation. So I'll bring from, you know, and Ken and I spend the last, you know, I don't know, decade, you know, talking every Monday, just shooting the shit, you know, talking mostly about movies, really. Right?
But, yeah. Nobody comes down to it.
When we got off movies, we'd better, but.
Well, was it Ken, you're talking about Ken Wilber, not Ken and Barbie here, right?
No, Ken. We'll get Ken and Barbie. Yeah. It's a good conversation.
And the integrals, you know, we went to the conference. Those were 2 or 3 years. We knew right. each other's work and things that.
Right,
were going
that's right. Yeah. There was a kind of overlapping, kind of, you know, beautiful interface. And at a certain point, you know, Ken and Zach and I kind of stepped, in a certain sense, away from the integral community, away from the kind of, you know, the little hub of integral life. Mm-hmm. Created this other hub, the Center for Integral Wisdom, which is, it got renamed for the third time, the Center for World Philosophy and Religion. But because we wanted to actually go to a broader world than the integral world. And the integral world, you know, you described it, you said a bunch of things in those 3-4 sentences, which is its own topic. How do worlds emerge, and how do they implode, and how do they explode, and how does the mothership disappear, and so that's a whole wonderful conversation. But maybe I'll freeze frame on one moment. Maybe take us into the kind of, you know, Andrew, what you framed, what Bonnie, you, Zach, and I talked about. I think Jordan was in that conversation as well, which is, what is the place of emergence and newness on the one hand? And what is the place of lineage, right, and tradition on the other? And I completely receive, you know, what you say, Bonnie, that we don't want to in any way pigeonhole this position. Clearly, Zach and I are not classical pre-modern traditionalists, and you're not
postmodern
reductionist. We both recognize, let's take as a given, that yes. we both recognize the importance of both. And so here's a moment, and that's why this conversation feels also, from a personal perspective and the broader sense, what is the relationship between those two? And that's such a critical issue. So there was a certain moment when Sean, who I just saw at my son's bar mitzvah, was so fun to be together. Sean Hargens was editing the, and my son just got bar mitzvah a week ago in Portland. So, and Sean's wife, Apostin, is best friends with Mariana. So,
but Sean's in Maine now. I just heard him on a podcast.
He's 3 hours away. So we're he's in the hood there, right? So he was, they did an issue of the integral journal, the academic journal, on my thought on unique self. And Ken and I were talking about the title of one of the essays I had written. And so we called it The Evolutionary Emergent of Unique Self. So then Ken and I got lost in this several hour conversation about, okay, on the one hand, we're saying that this notion of unique self, whatever it is, that's not our point now, is in some sense the 10th Oxfording picture in Buddhism. And you can actually locate it, you know, as in that image, he returns to the mark It's related to your traditions, Andrew, right? And we can locate it in, you know, in certain texts in Vajrayana, and we can locate it in Sahaj Samadhi, you know, when I return to this non-dual full union afternoon recovered Samadhi. And the other hand, we're calling it an evolutionary emergent. And then we're saying it's entirely new, that it's actually never existed before, and which is true. And which is a very, very fascinating, important, and critical question in terms of just how we think. Is unique self, and forget about unique self particularly, but anything, is something an entirely new emergent, and there's a kind of linear movement of emergence? Or is there a much more complex dance, right, in which ideas emerge? There's depths of lineage, there's transmission, we negate that which needs to be negated, we preserve that which is preserved, Hegel's famous term, and then we go to emerge. And if I'll just maybe open and then pass to you, what in a certain sense, Zach and I are insisting to each other, to ourselves, and Ken founded, in some sense, the think tank with us, because he felt that integral wasn't going that way, that actually it was going in a different direction, was losing touch with that, with this notion that new emergence, you know, and he shared that notion with us, needs to be rooted, you know, deep in lineage, and that without lineage, we actually get to this sense of almost like, let's start talking about physics without the lineages of physics, which is where much of the millennial community is. There's a kind of a refusal to engage lineage, which creates a kind of desiccated, so maybe that opens the conversation a little
bit. So did you want to say something, Andrew?
So this is the theory
of change. And it's complex. I think we hold this is a very interesting conversation, because I'm a critic of just about everything. So no one's going to be surprised. Because I think if we don't think radically enough, we stop too soon. But I think, you know, we're getting somewhere. But I'm a critic of emergentism, which is when people say, you know, you have matter and then life emerges. And to me, they don't have an it breaks the idea of a deep continuity of matter and life. And I think we use the term emergentism. That's the critique. I say it's more like emergentism. When we don't have a way to explain that there is a deep continuity, because we look in the past and we see discontinuity. So one of the examples is David Graeber talked about when you look at the archaeological record, you're only seeing men's work because they built things. And I don't want to get into a big patriarchy thing, but this is what he said. They built things that last. You don't see the interstitial things that were responsible for the changes, because they're like soft tissue. Everything else is like bones. And so when you look in the past, you see discontinuity. It's the same with my hands. When my hands are developing as a fetus, they're a web. I don't no longer see, like, there's extinction events, okay? So one could say that, so it's funny, because the person that's the anti-lineage is critiquing emergentism, but we're talking to the audience.
I was noticing that.
So because we're deepening the concepts, right? So, but I believe that there are leaps or I call them threshold events that where like history is distorted, or even that distort history in a way that when people look back, they'll completely reimagine what the historical record says, let's say. But it's not only an epistemic thing. These are ontologically real things. So we can call that emergence versus emergentism. So there's two things. If I want to recover my own consilience with lineage, I would say that you might be describing that understanding emergence, that emergence happens when there's a hard constraint called a lineage. Emergence happens when it's almost what I heard that you might be thinking, well, we need people to bump in up against continuity in order for emergence to happen, because that's the petri dish in which it happens. I could buy into that.
So let's no, that's great. That's great. Now, I mean, we're finding, I mean, and I'm actually really a feeling of just delight. I'm delighted to stumble into this conversation.
Yeah.
And we're kind of finding our way. So let's say a couple of things, and there, you threw out kind of so many illusions. There's so many ways to go. So let's, if we can find a couple of ways to go. So first, when we talk about, you know, in cosmorotic humanism, the story of value that Zach and I are trying to articulate, right? We have this, which we talked about at the seminar, we have this principle of continuity and discontinuity, which I think this is one of me, if I would say, if you'd ask me what's the most central principle, methodological principle in cosmorotic humanism, it's the principle of continuity and discontinuity. So we would apply that to something like, is love real? So my friend Howard Bloom, what Howard will say in the Lucifer principle, love's not real, right? And he'll level correct, you know, a correct, powerful postmodern critique. And he'll say, oh, love meant this 1500 years ago. It means this now. You're calling them both love. That's a joke, right? Love's not real. And I'll say to Howard, which we have over the years, and he's beginning to come on board, and Howard's fantastic and wonderful. And I've learned so much science from Howard. But Howard, you know, we would say back to Howard, no, actually, love or eros does mean something. It means something quite specific. And we've actually formulated an interior science equation of what eros means.
Right.
You know, as the experience of radical aliveness, desiring ever deeper contact, ever greater wholeness, you know, in a word. And then eros evolves. So eros is both real. It's a real value of cosmos. Eros is not a thing. It's eros value. It's a value of cosmos. So it's both, there's continuity and discontinuity. And that begins to bring us into lineage. And then maybe one more image and pass back to you. But here'd be the second image. So there's an image of it. And of course, you know, I'll be naturally, because it's where I swim and feel, you know, a deep intimacy, even though I have a deep also revulsion at certain dimensions of lineage, right? You know, but there's an intimacy at the same time. So Luria had this idea that Isaac Luria in the, you know, 16th century, whose ideas animate the mystery schools that animated so much of the Renaissance, Luria talks about lines and circles. So lines and circles, a line would be the movement forward, right? The creative advance of novelty emergence. But when evolution moves forward, and there's this radical newness, this radical emergence, what it's first doing is, that's the line moving, the circle is receiving the entire moment, everything from before. So everything that's happened in evolution before is being fully received, the circle completely receives it, it's all present, and then from that, there's this leap of emergence.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this line and circle moment, so that in, if we'll borrow Whitehead's term, in the occasion receives everything that came from before and then kind of thrusts forward. So that's this line, circle, Heros Gamos moment. So it seems like if we're going to create a new grammar of value, and the world depends on it, and we don't create a new grammar of value, we get jihad. I mean, we get cultures of death. We get tragedy, right? We get, you know, beautiful Palestinian aspirations, which are gorgeous and holy, that get hijacked by Hamas, which, you know, is just right, not where we want to be, because we haven't articulated a genuine grammar of value, because we don't know how to, because the generations that are you know, in the universities writing and talking have a kind of aversion to actually receiving the moment that came before. And actually, you know, our friend who actually, I don't know him well, but he's a lovely young man who sat on the porch with me, that you'll be going to visit. So I actually asked him when we sat, our mutual colleague Layman brought over a bunch of people, I think from an event that you might have even been at, right, to the porch here. And I said to them, I said, you know, I glanced at your work before you came just to kind of honor it. And I said, there was so much that wasn't cited that you had clearly read. So why aren't you citing? Like, why aren't you? And the answer was something like, there was no sense of like, no, actually, we're going to receive something.
Yeah.
It was, and I mean, I remember, Bonnie, and this is like the last thought, my teacher, who I would say disagreed with everything I've done in the last 25 years. He was my teacher when I was 17 or 18, Aaron Lichtenstein. I mean, I would follow him. I would go to the class and listen to every word he said, listen to every, like, I would watch him walk. I would follow him around. He was this righteous man who embodied, right, wisdom. He wrote his doctorate in 19 at Harvard on Henry Moore and the Cambridge Neoplatonists. And he was a great Talmudic scholar. And I was madly devoted to his depth, not as a guru,
right,
but as an incarnation of realized lineage. And without that kind of devotion, right, to lineage, what will happen is we won't generate something new. Mm-hmm. We'll generate something enormously superficial that won't stand the test. And the test is we've got to reject jihad. We've got to reject kind of the fundamentalisms of pseudo-eros, which emerged because we don't have a field of Eros value. And we have to reject Andrew. We talked about, you know, a few weeks ago, we got to reject Barbie, which says Ken and Barbie, there's no Ken and Barbie. You know, in that new Barbie movie, there is no Ken and Barbie. There is no love story. So we can only do that if we actually, so like on this topic of the universal love story, I'm looking every place in the world for any source and any text that had an elusive notion of the universal love story, and I want to merge it with the best of the sciences, and then an emergent happens. So that's a little bit the sense, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, and it's all very stable. One of the things I'm realizing, maybe we started by we're asked to be doing something new here in a greater reality, and maybe it's just this. It's maybe we are the thought process, because you're right, these are big questions in the different initiatives in our community around, you know, we have both a return to lineage, we have Peugeot and Vanderclay and a Christian kind of return, re-examination of Neoplatonic, Abrahamic, let's say, lineages. And then we have metamodern, which is much highly more emergentism, I would put it a little to that end. Mm-hmm. And these have not been well articulated. They're terms that inspire our community, but these distinctions are not well articulated. So maybe that's the work we're doing for the community. I don't know. One of the things I heard in what you were saying is that love is what Whitehead would call an evolving eternal. So it's not like a Platonic eternal, but it has characteristics of what a Platonic eternal is, but it's an evolving eternal. So I resonated with that. I understand that. And then I just want to make two small points, and you know, you're good at everything, so I take advantage of that. I no longer am trying to, I'm just gonna work with it. So two things. One is that, and I loved your circle and line, because I'm working with someone here this week, and one of the critical insights that we had is that when you look at evolution and these leaps, and even at the beginning, we were talking about the beginning of the universe and Hawking's newest last final theory, we use this term bifurcation event. And what I was saying was, but a bifurcation event, because there's symmetry breaking. And so we use the term bifurcation event in symmetry breaking. And I said, no, symmetry breaking is not a bifurcation event. the Wu Ji doesn't split into yin and yang. It explodes into many, many, many variations, and then things get culled. So one of the things I would say is that, but that's what I saw, what you said, here's lineage, and then it just doesn't bifurcate. Here's the circle. It explodes into this, you know, like the octopus. I don't know if you saw my octopus teacher. She,
yes.
You know, she has all these babies, and she gets completely metabolized in the process of giving birth. This is also important for me as a metaphor that is a little bit of a critique of lineage, because I asked Zach this, and we didn't have a chance to talk about it, but it, you know, are these things completely metabolized at these, I don't know what to call them, radial expansion events? They're not bifurcation events. So that's one thing I like to put in the mix. But here's, like, I think the heart, and you said we were on the same page here in the email, so maybe you can get me from here to there. And that mm-hmm. is that, you know, I'm trying to write a book too. So a lot of these ideas I'm struggling with as I'm trying to write the book and don't know how to write what I'm trying to say. One is that prior to Socrates, prior to civilization building, and you know, we just use this term in indigenous cultures. I don't want to overdo that term. But I have an academic citation for it, Barry Sanderwell's Low Geological Investigations, 3-volume, amazing piece of work that no one in their right mind would read. But he talks about the archaic mind, and he traces the archaic mind into the pre-Socratic mind and then into European video logical. Anyways, but in way back when humans, when they told the story of their lineage, it was grounded in the story of the cosmos and the earth and nature. And then at some point, the Bible says, God created, he spent 6 days, 5 days creating everything, and then he creates Adam and Eve. And now the story really gets exciting, right? That happened at a time in history where people stopped tracing themselves. And then, of course, with the Western Enlightenment, the problem we have in tracing ourselves all the way back is you have to code switch to a language that sounds like physics. Once I get to the genealogy of the earth, then I talk about inanimate matter and the mechanisms of electrons and molecules. And my concern, my mission, my project is to enable people to see their continuity, that their belongingness is not a story of these two humans, this culture, but that it has to be a story that's much deeper than that. And it's a genealogical story, well, with the earth, that's one. And I know you guys go all the way metaphysically to the cosmos, so you have that piece. So we're not like completely out, but
maybe
you could talk to that.
No, well, first off, it's just, here's the thing. So, and it's great. In the academy, when, you know, when I say the academy, I mean the kind of Western academy.
Yeah.
Right. When you write something and someone tells you, oh, somebody else wrote that, you're devastated. Right. In the best of seminary, and the seminaries have a lot of worst of them, so I don't want to idealize them.
Yeah.
In the best of what they call the yeshiva, right? The yeshiva, the place, right? So there's a phrase when someone says something and then someone else says something similar, you say, Baruch Shekivanti, blessed is source, that I'm in the right direction, that I've intended in the right way. Mm-hmm. There's an excitement when we have overlapping magisterium of ideas, there's excitement. And so my sense is actually from everything you've said, Bonnie, is that we're overlapping and playing and expressing and articulating in a, you know, a wonderfully mutually, you know, kind of fructifying, exciting way. right? And I was just excited about using the word fructifying. So just
I know I put fruits and flowers at the top.
I know fruits and flowers are fruits and flowers, right? So first let me, and again, I'm going to try and follow your thread. Let me just give the beginning of your thread first, which is you exactly, you know, got that sense of what I was trying to say about love, right? I'm going to say at the core of cosmorotic humanism is this sentence, the eternal Tao is the evolving Tao.
Yeah.
Right. Now, that idea, right, we can actually feel it. And here's the thing, we can feel it in our bodies. We can actually feel in our bodies that eternity and evolution are not a polarity, but a paradox in the best sense of the word. So the eternal Tao is, you know, Tao is the evolving Tao. And paradoxically, we can't talk about lineage all in one, lineage is not of a piece.
Mm-hmm. You know,
most lineages deny the fact that they evolve. So there's a kind of, it's one of the weaknesses of lineages that I think that's part of where your aversion comes from. And I share that. Right? They pretend like evolution is not happening when actually it is.
Right. Or they just have a bifurcation event. So here's this, and now there's Christianity, and then there's this, and they're all bifurcations. It's not a rich enough metaphysics to explain the human project.
Right. There's this deeper notion, which is that to kind of cite one text, there's a very, very beautiful text, which the community of intimate scholars who are intimate with cosmos and text disagree with God, and they override God. And God says, "Nitzchuni banai, my children have triumphed over me," or they've made me eternal because they're evolving me, mm-hmm. right? And I think we have to actually speak of lineage in that way, in which on the one hand, we're devotional to the lineage, and at the same time, we are, to borrow that beautiful word that you put into the conversation, you know, three nuggets ago, you know, radical, mm-hmm. you know, we have to go to the root, and we have to be kind of, you know,
yes, radical root, yes,
right, radical root in that kind of very, very, very radical way. So that's kind of the first notion. Now,
can I just jump in here with one thing?
Please.
This idea of radicalness being lineage is something I've always thought about, because unless you are in touch with the radical lineage, then nothing new will emerge. You're just kind of spinning around. That's the sense I always got. So the artists and poets that I appreciate, they go to the radical root, not to repeat the same stories, the same axioms, the same narratives, but to rediscover them and that makes something genuinely, let's say, prophetic or new or interesting arise.
Yeah, totally.
My defense of lineage is a defense of the poetics of lineage rather than the power of lineage. The fact of it being a source.
Yeah.
Not that power is not important, but primarily the poetics. If that makes any sense. I don't know if that is what you are saying. Yep.
I think I can now. I think this is all very good because we're mapping our conversation instead of just jumping. So I would say, so we have this notion of radical and root, which is beautiful. And when I hear you feed back your comment about lineage, I understand that. And now I think that I'm going to try to get you to understand me a little better, okay? So I don't believe going to the beginning of culture is radical enough in this radical time that we're. I think nature has a powerful critique on culture as thinking of itself as the origin of humanity. Now, I'm not trying to get you to agree. I think it can be separate work, but this was when you said Andrew lineage, I get it. Like your lineage and culture. If you're going to, you know, I have horse gurus who not every person I respect in the horse, and they've taught me like about so much about your animal nature, and then the only way to learn from them is to do it exactly the way they say for years and years and years before you can go on. That is a lineage. There are now, obviously, what I say, it's not one lineage. It's a lot of constellations of Whitehead and Christopher Alexander and Zach and Mark are in there. And all these things are holding me up. I'm not just a blurb out of nowhere. But when I think of lineage, I think it goes all the way to the root, which means I think that we have, Jung said that he talked about the collective unconscious. And so if you and I are, if I have a blind spot, then I need to be in dialogue with another person because they can see my blind spot. But if you and I are both Westerners, we all grew up the same, then we have a collective blind spot, right? So we have to go outside. And there's a point at which, and late in his writings, Jung faced this, that the species, the human species, has a blind spot. And the question is, where do you go? You have to go the next larger universal. And I take seriously, and I'm not like some retro romantic indigenous person, but I think we need to, so I see lineage as kind of very extremely important, but then to expand the greater reality, we have a planet that is dying, that we have a situation that imperils not only human culture as it's known, but all human culture forever. And for me, I don't find in any of the post-Socratic lineages an acknowledgement of that things come from the earth, they come out of the earth. I think you and Zach do a great job then tying it into cosmology, but this middle level, we don't understand. People don't understand it. And it just, so that's just what.
Beautiful.
What, yeah.
No, this is great. This is great. Now we can, now the conversation almost begins, right? This is where it gets exciting and important and critical. And paradoxically, I'm surprised each second by how actually closely aligned we are.
Yeah, you said that in the email.
Right. So in other words, so here's where it's surprising and beautiful and exciting, right? Which is the weakness of lineage, or the way you described going back to comments, the kind of biblical story coming out of the earlier ages in which we get to this, Adam human, which begins this kind of human, story. And you talked about the need to root it further back. That is exactly, in a word, what the intuition of cosmorotic humanism is. And it's paradoxical. Here I am, here is Zach, we're talking about lineage. You're talking about, we're having this conversation, but actually you've created your own intuitive, independent world, right? Out of which you operate, and chose, not by accident, not to operate within the confines of, university. Zach and I decided not to be in Harvard and Oxford. Ken decided to have his loft in Denver and not operate. In other words, so on the one hand, we're talking about lineage. On the other hand, we've all stepped out of the classical structures of both academic and religious lineage, mm-hmm. at least institutionally, right, intuitively, in order to create something new. Now, with that in mind, the basic understanding and intuition and realization of cosmorotic humanism is that lineage has to be the universe's lineage, the cosmic mm-hmm. lineage, and it has to move through. It has to have first principles and first values that are rooted not at the human level per se, but are rooted in the world of matter,
yes,
and in the world of life, and then in the world of self-reflective human mind. So even, I want to give one example because it'll make it most real. We talked about it briefly at the seminar, but take something like story, which we assume story is a human notion, right? Humans, self-reflective humans, enact story. So what we're saying in cosmorotic humanism is no, actually story is a structure of cosmos. And that what story means is that there's a plot line, that there's desire to fulfill that value, and there's a degree of freedom. It's not a mechanical manual, there's a degree of freedom. And that those four elements of story operate actually at the world of matter, and they actually operate at the world of the biosphere and at the world of self-reflective human. However, when we go back to what you said earlier, Bonnie, it's continuity and discontinuity. So there's a principle of story. That story evolves, there's an evolution of story, and yet there's very clearly discontinuity of story. So the stories of, you know, Andrew and Bonnie and Mark are different than the stories of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And yet, right, there's a fundamental continuity. And whether we're talking about uniqueness, or we're talking about eros, or we're talking about diversity, right, or we're talking about, right, care, all of, we've tried to name 18 first principles and first values, all of them, if they're not backed by the universe, it's not just that they're wrong, meaning they're contrived in some way, which I think what we're sharing, that's what I'm saying, that's the depth of our shared intuition. It's not just that they're contrived. It's not just that they lack sufficient eros to fill us. So therefore, in the vacuum, pseudo eros and all its destructive, you know, ring of Sauron forms will emerge. They don't work. Right. They're just not, they're a violation of cosmos. So we need to be cosmoerotic, right? And any, the claim of lineage, and now I'm actually understanding much more clearly that actually your critique of lineage is actually identical with that which we're critiquing in cosmoerotic humanism, and what a joy in that, right? Meaning having that. So it's actually much, much even closer than I thought. And if it's not backed by the universe, right? Then we can't be, I mean, last sentence, we're either welcome in the universe or we're not.
We either think we're welcome in the universe or not.
No, so let's make sure but we clarify.
This is a hair splitting thing. It just
let me just for fun push back, and then you push back, right? Which is not we think. In other words, we think, but we think in our deepest heart's desire, our deepest inner knowing, what we would call our anthro-ontology, the ontology that if we think about it deeply enough, we can trust the nature of that thought of God that arises in us.
Yes.
And if we know what we know based on that feeling, thought, embodiment. And so we actually have this experience, we're welcome in the universe, and we can't be welcome in the universe unless we go way before any lineage, and that we actually have a universal lineage of value that's grounded in the nature of cosmos and earth and biology and humanity. Yeah. Otherwise, literally not welcome in the universe. I mean, it's that basic.
So, yeah, and this is, you know, your use of the word story, it's not, I don't use it often, but it reminds me of Rich Blundell's work. And he says, when you look at the cosmic microwave background radiation, it's already a story, because there's a pattern. It's not just blah. There's things are going to move in some directions and not in others. And he has a really beautiful way of, you know, they go on an Earth story. He does these workshops. He goes on an Earth story. And beautiful. Then he'll say, see what I'm doing? I'm doing storying, which is what the Earth is doing. So there's a lot of
I wasn't familiar with that, but yeah, and there's a plot.
Yeah, a plot line, yeah. So that I agree with, and so this is good, because I just use these two terms. You may want to use them or not. I use the anthro-ontology as a lineage, and then when it goes deeper than the human, I use the word genealogy, which is just the same as a lineage. But when we use the word lineage, we tend to think of this subset of the genealogy. Anyways, if we want to get on the same page with that.
Yeah, yeah.
What I like a lot about this idea of a story, a story has discontinuity and continuity at the same time. And it occurs to me, if we look at great art, it's not a complete picture. It's not a Platonic model. It's not a, you know, it always has a an undoing. It always has an absence. It always has a lack. It always has a death. It always has something that is not, that is incomplete, or something like that. So that's, it's beautiful to think that there's a plot, and yet that plot is, if we were too strictly adherent to that plot, then we would have Hollywood, you know, bullshit, but we'd have,
think jazz symphony instead of only formal symphony. And it's not just that when I play a symphony, if I'm a particular conductor with a particular set of players, I can play Mozart uniquely. No, it's actually a jazz symphony, right? I'm actually creating, right, new emergence, but that emergence comes from, that was your distinction beautiful earlier, Bonnie, between emergence and emergentism, right? That emergence is coming from this very deep listening, right, to all of the other players in the symphony, a deep receiving of the music, right? And then there's this moment when it's mine to play, and my quartet and the unique self symphony kind of, right, emerges, but I'm in deep concert with the symphony in a very, very profound way.
Yeah. Have this cool conversation. So I do this workshop that I use. It's based on circus jazz, and circus jazz starts with Billy Bang or something. You know, it's very improvisational, but you can hear the swing beat, and the swing beat keeps people engaged. And when we look at, like, Andrew, you said great art, and we look at, like, the history of art, we jump from nodes to nodes to nodes to nodes, because the interstitial experiments, that wasn't great art, so you don't see it. And these nodes, right, these nodes are like the swing beats in jazz. Right. And in circus jazz, they start to build more and more notes in between the notes. And when I do the workshop, people's minds actually get rewired, because at first you just hear a wall, and then you hear what we're talking about is not just syncopation, and not just, you hear all the things that really hold the piece together, and all the things in which they're useful, but they're not as important. And so when we talk about lineage, even when we talk about genealogy, because of epistemic constraints, we tell the story through the nodes. Mm-hmm. The story always looks more discontinuous than it is, because there's all this interstitial fabric that gets culled when humans tell a story, for one thing. And a lot of the interstitial fabric has to do with considering the earth and nature and the cosmos, as you say, as backdrop, instead of part of the composition. You know, all these things are, I would say, articulating a new mind. And I think that obviously, the ways in which you're radicalizing, or you have your own vernacular, is reflecting on people. Like, they're like, you know, this is what I joke about Ken, right? When people read Ken, it was like, wow, it was a mind blowing, but it reflected back to something they already knew. So in a very short period of time, they like, oh, I already knew that, because there's something latent in the imagination already, that if you can match it with the vernacular, then, like my student said, it's like we're a flash mob waiting to happen, but we don't know. You know, so everybody's like walking toward some kind of attractor. I think that was the other thing that I was trying to, it was just like a pedagogical approach that I was noticing was happening in real life at the time, And anyways, but I don't even think you disagree with this. I don't know why it would blow up. But,
no, it's beautiful, right? It's and here's just emerging out of emerging, not emergentisming, yeah. Right, but emerging out of what you're saying. There's, which is the context of the meta crisis or of existential risk means that this is not a conversation in a Parisian salon in the 18th century. I mean, the fucking future of reality is at stake. And if our two choices basically are Hamas or Barbie, you know, Barbie says there's no Barbie in Ken, you know, and I mean, our choices, right? I mean, there's this scene in Barbie where Sasha, the daughter, you know, says, you know, the patriarchal, you know, piggish head of Mattel says, well, what's going to happen with Barbie? And Sasha says, well, she's in love with Ken. And Barbie says, I'm not in love with Ken. And what she means is not, I'm not in love with this Ken, but no, Barbie's not in love with Ken. There's no love story. It's girls night forever, you know, and this notion of our cosmos just isn't true. So that's kind of the ultimate triumph of kind of postmodernism in this chilling movie. There's no love story. And then Hamas says, oh yeah, there is a love story. And it's this very narrow love story in which, right, I'm loved in a very particular way. And anyone who's not loved in this way is subject to, you know, Deir al-Harb, you know, Deir al-Harb, right, to the sword in the most brutal way. And you get kind of fundamentalisms, whether they're, you know, and every religion has its fundamentalisms. So either we have Hamas or Barbie, both of those will destroy the world. And if we don't at the center, right, actually find the places where we share this deep common ground and we don't emerge together this very compelling story, which we're taking a stand on. We're not saying this is cute. We're not saying, oh, we have this interesting idea. We're saying, you know, actually there's fucking value at the very center of the cosmos. And the cosmos has first principles and first values, and they evolve and they matter. And our choices matter, and we are welcome in the universe. And there's a universal ground of value that, as you say, is not late lineage. It's not Adam and Eve. It's ground in reality itself. If we can't say that in a compelling way, then existential risk in its worst form wins the day. And so that's, in other words, what keeps me awake. I know what keeps you awake, Andrew, and I don't know what your relationship is. I know a little bit less, Andrew, to this topic, but what keeps us awake, right, where Zach and I have been talking for the last, you know, 10, 15 years is, oh my God, infrastructure is not going to do it, right? Social structure is not going to do it. We need a new superstructure. We need a new story of value. And so in a certain sense, it's the urgency of coming together and clarifying each other and making each other wiser, right? And even when, you know, I was talking to Ken a while ago, when he started writing and when we first met, existential risk wasn't in the center of consciousness in the same way. The Club of Rome had done what the Club of Rome had done. And you know, when we were familiar with it and it was in the, and I remember watching, Ken and I talked about it. I remember watching an episode of Madam Secretary. I was watching it with Sally Kempton. It was Madam Secretary, Netflix, right? You know, sorry, everybody. And it was one episode around existential risk. And there was a character, was the one person in the office who took existential risk seriously. And basically the plot line, this was, you know, 15 years ago, the plot line was, what an idiot.
Yeah,
right. The plot line was he was the person who kind of like, whatever, okay, get over it, it's fine. And this person was citing all the information, and Madam Secretary and everyone, you know, the heroic movement was, that's ridiculous. So neither the original thinking I did the first 25 years, or Zach's, you know, work in development, or probably your early work or Ken's work, was actually in response to the meta crisis. It wasn't really, for me anyways, till 2009 or 10, where I began to realize, oh my God, right? Like, oh my God, right? Like, oh my God, right?
What did Zach write about the Nuos arc? That was one of the first very serious responses to what he saw was coming. Remember he wrote about the Nuos arc? We need,
Was that the War of Heavens, or is it way?
No, no, this much earlier.
Okay. He wrote the first thing we wrote. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the Noah's Ark. No. We wrote in 2011 an article called The Second Shock of Existence.
Yeah.
It may have been in there. I don't remember. I don't remember actually, but yeah, it was 2009, 10, 11. Yeah. And therefore the urgency of us coming together and creating, because there's not 1,000 of us in the world. Right. And then there's so, you know, when you have, this goes back to that question about community and how communities fracture and all the things.
Say that again. There's not 1,000 of us.
Meaning if the community of people, right, who can actually begin to articulate a shared grammar of value, right, actually splinters among itself, right, and gets involved in kind of the usual fractious, you know, things that communities do.
Right.
At a time when the world is burning, right, we will have been wildly, wildly irresponsible, right, major an understatement to the very future of the planet. And that's why I was excited to do the seminar and to begin to have conversations and to begin to bridge divides, right, to actually find what's urgent for us and what's urgent for reality. And we need each other in the most beautiful way.
We need a critical mass. I mean, I agree with you there. I just want to nuance this a little bit. Like there aren't 1,000 of us, but there's a billion in waiting. That people are starving to hear a story of value in your terms, or to have something that's reflected back to something that's already percolating in them.
Yes.
And they go from one to another, and this is of course the process. I'm not saying it's a problem, that we haven't captured it yet. And that's what I call latency. Like part of the job of the us, the meager, not 1,000, is to hold on to our work, and we both hold on to it quite, Zach talks about teacherly authority. I bark at my students. Like, they have to use the words right to get anywhere. You know, there's a certain discipline, but as teachers, we need to also see that. And maybe at the end of the day, we're forgotten or we're remembered as a node, but that's not important, because the interstitial evolutionary process is already happening in people that don't know it. And our job is to recognize that in the individuals, whether they're postmodern, confused, or techno-erotic, because how do we, and maybe this is a conversation we can have at a next symposium, how do we incorporate that seeing knowing? And as teachers, it's very important because old-fashioned ideas of lineage, and I'm not accusing you of that, no longer have the kind of sustenance, because the generations change too fast. So they can't take advantage of what is already coming down the pike, because that's the power in Hamas. I mean, there's so much momentum in that argument, and there's so much momentum in the nation state argument. There has to be a huge amount of momentum in the system that we're trying to appeal to, and I believe we can see it. See it. So that's the notion of latency.
Yeah.
That maybe we could invite people. Daniel Thorson would be happy to talk to you. You know, and he probably is talking to you about that. But that was just the other.
Yeah.
You know, piece.
And I love the term latency, and I appreciate that we have this deep shared ground see if we can kind of feel two things in it. In other words, the lineage in the old sense of the term, which is a particular narrow chauvinistic national or even simply human lineage, right, ultimately doesn't work, right? We need a lineage
today.
Right? It doesn't work. And largely because it's grounded only in the reverential memory of the past, right? And a genuine
beautiful, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Story of value has to access the memory of the future.
Exactly.
Right. And so but let me try and shift, you know, and there's a lot to say about that. And I would love to talk about that, but I want to maybe just pivot for a second. And again, I apologize for this, but to also just kind of, you know, in the most personal way, as we started, I think we all, you know, Andrew, Bonnie, Mark, right, but all us, but all also, you know, in the larger, we have to love each other. I mean, it seems like a silly thing to say, but it's not, right? In other words, when I say love each other, it doesn't mean we need to get married, doesn't mean we need to like each other in every second, right? In terms of right, but it means that actually that there's this sense that of genuine love, which is not limited to our biological families, that we love and honor each other, we hold each other dearly, that we actually get beyond all of those strategies of, you know, of what Zach and I call anti-value, you know, the ontologies of evil, if you will, right, that actually move to split people.
Mm-hmm.
And to split movements and to split directions. And that, you know, I mean, you almost want to kind of invoke Benjamin Franklin, you know, either we all hang together or we all hang separately. But there's the sense where, I mean, and again, Bonnie and Andrew, I apologize for the forthrightness of it, but I'm excited to fall in love with Andrew. And I'm excited to fall in love with Bonnie. When I say fall in love, I don't mean it in a romantic way, but I do mean that we're together romancing the cosmos, and that we're nodes in this story, and we actually are an evolutionary family. There is a familia, right? We are, I mean, we all grew up in different places, right? In very, very different contexts, you know, social context, religious context, geographic context, and yet here we are drawn to each other because the intimate universe has drawn us together, and that we should, you know, behind the scenes and in front of the scenes and talk to each other and honor each other, mm-hmm. and the intimacy between each other is something that seems so lost. And I not only have a yearning for it, I think that it's going to be our future, right? If we can't love each other,
yeah.
Right? You know, and create real intimate communion, then what are we doing? And I think that just being able to do that and that in this conversation and at the seminar, in that most personal way, you know, the personal and the cosmic meet,
mm-hmm.
in some deep way. So something like that.
Yeah, you know, I was roommate with Christina.
Right.
And yeah. And she's like, she's really good. She's like, why are you people, you know, me and other people that knew each other better, why are you even here? And it's because we love the other people that are here. I mean, it was completely driven by a call that we couldn't refuse, right? And I think this is important because I think that if exactly what you're saying, if people acknowledge that that's the important piece and that the propositional contestations are part of the evolutionary process, it's a different kind of consilience. It's noticing that someone that irritates me and noticing that without a doubt they're in my orbit. I can pretend they're not, or I can pretend I'm not in their orbit, but we're orbiting something. We don't know what we're orbiting, but to pretend you're not in the same orbit because you disagree is pretending, right? So I think, and this is a story that's happened over the last couple of years and in different forms, And so to me, that's part of the latency. People, and so, yeah, beautiful. That's
What I like here is the Mark evoking that we need to love each other, and you describing that as a calling, and that those two things are very, those are,
it's not a propositional, it's an indubitable calling.
It's not like loving each other, like because we're the same, or because we're, you know, because we're in the same religion, even, you know.
That's right.
You didn't manufacture it. You probably sometimes don't even want it. Yeah. And yet to deny it is to deny your own uniqueness, or, you know, it's like you start to feel the universe is conspiratorial in some way. Which is
last night I was at a group with Gurdjieff group, and in the group there was a Muslim guy, there was, you know I'm a tantric Buddhist, there's a bunch of different people from different religion. We're all sitting talking about Gurdjieff. It's like, how did this happen? Because in a traditional lineage, you'd stick around the people who are like you, right? Or who have the same mythopoetic superstructure story as you do. But it seems that what's interesting here is actually like the difference, the fact, the possibility of those tribal boundaries being broken, like as in the Ivan Illich story, where, you know, we did a course on Ivan Illich, and he takes the Samaritan, you know, he speaks about the Samaritan, which is breaking the tribal boundary, and making a choice, like a unique choice to lift the guy out of the ditch, or choose your relationships with the people who you're called to be with.
Yeah, and to receive, then to bring it back, you know, Bonnie, Andrew, to bring it back to, you know, the meandering thousand, you know, Paul Tillich, you know, points out that in the Renaissance, there were about 1,000 people involved, right? You think it was this mass, but actually at the core of the Renaissance, right, Florence and a couple of other cities, there were about 1,000 players, says Tillich, which is fascinating. And if you feel into it, it's not just that we have to love each other, and not love each other from a kind of supercilious sameness, as you say, Andrew, but from this kind of radical individuation. But what we also have to do is actually celebrate each other's attainment and celebrate each other's unique attainment, right? In other words, I had written these bunch of volumes called Radical Kabbalah, and it's actually how I met Zach, and I send Ken an early version of, like, I don't know, a couple thousand pages, right? And it was like 4 volumes, and he just read through them, you know, in a period of, you know, 3 nights, and marked them up and sent them to Clint, I sent them to Zach, and they started getting passed around. And, you know, and Ken called me and said, when we had been arguing about 4 or 5 major issues for a bunch of years, right? And he said, wow, I got it. Now I get what you're saying. You know, now I get what you mean. This is actually this notion of irreducible uniqueness, right? And we went from true self to uniqueness, whatever that whole story was, right? And he was so madly excited about it, right? In other words, he didn't say, right, wow. He said, wow, this is a whole new chapter in integral theory. And every time Ken and I clashed, and I learned so much from him, right? He was radically excited to get, oh, wow, now I get what you mean, second person. And we would talk about it that way. And I'd get what he means. And so, and when Zach came, you know, when we started studying, you know, in Holy of Holies, and I realized, oh, and we'd studied for years. And then, you know, there was one day where I was thinking about something that had to do with development. And I talked to Zach about it. And Zach said, that's ridiculous. You can't think about development that way. You got to think about development this way. And I was, I hadn't quite gotten, I'd been teacher for many years. I hadn't quite gotten how deep his developmental knowing was. I said, teach me development. Right. Oh my God, that's so exciting. And I'm literally wildly excited, right, when I can celebrate some new huge depth of knowledge, but not in that way, you know, where, you know, Barbara and I used to tease Barbara Marks Hubbard, you know, we would be at a teaching and someone would say something and she would say, oh, that's your Dharma. And I'd say, no, that's not your Dharma. That's just something someone said, right? You know? That's not a Dharma. And, you know, and let's not do this kind of leveling of differences and just like make everything a Dharma. Then it gets ridiculous, right? No, actually, but the people that are doing a Dharma, right? Right. And that's a few, there's a few, right? Let's celebrate each of us and actually begin to feel that we each have this unique piece of the story, right? And so when I talked to my little brother, Daniel, right? Not Daniel Thorson, Daniel Schmachtenberger, and Daniel's, you know, working on kind of infrastructure, and he has a piece of something that I haven't seen, right? I'm delighted. And Daniel calls, he's delighted to hear. I remember, you know, I was just watching a clip the other night because Christina, my partner, is making this movie. And I was watching a clip of when I, in 2014-13, when I was sharing with Daniel Unique Self, right? You know, Schmachtenberger, and Daniel was so excited. And his face was like pure and excited. And it was such a beautiful moment. And we, and I'm wildly excited when Daniel points out something to me that I just didn't know. And so, and so when Bonnie, there were three or four times when you said things at the seminar, right? It wasn't that first morning, it was a little later, right? Yeah. But right, where I was like, oh, that was, and I jotted, that was really good. That was really like, oh, cha. And I was excited.
Yeah. So
we get to get excited about each other in the best way. You know, that's that, and that begins to create something real that can actually respond.
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you felt, I did, yes, there was opportunity to contribute, certainly at many times too, in almost everything I had to offer were how it mapped onto process philosophy, which you innately knew, but I was just giving terms and stuff. Yeah, but noticing that was in, you know, different languages, but that was already in the system, yeah.
Yeah, no, totally. It's exciting. It's exciting. I just a last anecdote, and maybe Andrew, I mean, I think we got to do a lot of clarification today. I wrote David Ray Griffin before he passed. I had never met him, and I actually discovered him late. And so I, you know, kind of devoured a bunch of his writing, and I didn't realize he was sick. So I wrote him and, you know, talked to him about cosmorotic humanism and wanted to get on the phone. He couldn't talk already. You know, he was at the very, very end, and writing. He had written that he had finished a book about death, and asked if we would do a review. So I think Zach and I will do a review as kind of his book on death. But he said, you know, he basically said, you know, Whitehead loves cosmorotic humanism, essentially, in an email. And we were so delighted by, and David was such a great example. Here's a guy who has a major life's work. Mm-hmm. He's done a fucking awesome job, somewhat uncelebrated, right? And others, he's kind of hasn't, you know, and he was just, and he was clearly at the last weeks of his life, right? And he was just so delighted to celebrate, you know, this new emergence. Yeah. And there wasn't a drop of, and he felt our just complete admiration for his life work.
Yeah.
And we didn't need to cloak it or to, right? And just that simple, like, I get to be excited about Bonnie and I don't have to apologize for
it.
Done.
No, I think it's all good. I mean, one of the things, you know, I used to teach organizational development a lot. And one of the things I would counsel people is, it's called the free energy principle. And that is, you look in the organization and you see deviance, you know, or if you're a teacher and you see students have all this energy to be mischievous, instead of trying to push it down, you say, oh, that's energy for free, right? That it's in the system and it's energy for free. And you should always try to recognize it as something you can work with. It's the same with horses, you know, I mean, it's much nicer to ride a horse that has energy but doesn't know where to put it, then you have to keep, right? And except it requires, it's a challenge to leadership to work with energy that's in the system for free. And so, to, you know, just to reflect back to you, I know that you were very skillful in working with that energy that came to you somewhat freely.
Well, the thing about that was that it kind of...
I didn't charge you, so...
That's clear.
Maybe people don't really know what we're talking about, but, you know, there was some fireworks going on at this event, and in a way that made it much more real, so in many ways. I mean, it could have been just a yes conference. It could have been just an affirmation, and you know. But that's not always the best thing, is it?
We the whole conference was very clearly taking this existential risk seriously, and that kind of heightened, I think, the sense of urgency not to dilly-dally, yeah. Or if and then things just, it had a lot of energy, you know, there was a lot of transformational energy and came to that symposium, and I don't think it was by accident.
No, I don't think it was. And I mean, if you'll allow me, right, I have a moment of it. It's been for me a difficult, I mentioned in our three-way email, I haven't slept a lot in these last 3 weeks. It's a little bit of an insane time. I actually just on my text thread just saw that my son, who's in reserve, so he's a commander of commandos in the Israeli army in reserves. So now the reservists are now going, you know, into Gaza. So that was just a couple of hours ago, right before. So, and all of us are devastated. We're devastated for every innocent death in Gaza, right? We're devastated for Palestinians, or, you know, being hijacked by Hamas. We're devastated, obviously, for Israel. And so it's been a tense and painful time. And in the midst of this, I'm feeling in this moment just enormous hope, right? You know, just enormous hope from this conversation. Because, and again, without, I don't think we need to fill everyone in on kind of exactly how the seminar unfolded, but we could easily have had an engagement of kind of an intense early engagement and drawn egoic lines of separation.
Yeah.
Right. And literally told the story forever, right? Based on dividing those lines. But what we actually all did intuitively, you know, I did and Bonnie did and, you know, and Zach did and everyone did, and, you know, and Jordan, and, you know, you, Andrew, we all kind of used that energy and actually found each other deeper through it. And here we are. And it just fills me actually with hope and goodness.
And I can think of many times where I wish.
I think we erased some of those lines that had been drawn.
We did.
I think that predated this, and that was the transformative piece, I think.
Yeah. Thank you.
No, I was just going to say that when that doesn't happen, when the lines get drawn, that remains painful forever. It seems like.
Exactly.
So it's such a relief when that doesn't happen.
No. And what Bonnie, I think you were pointing to is that, you know, there's always, we so often come in with pre-drawn lines, and I mean, the simple joy of being face to face with people and being in dialogos, right. And finding each other, whether it's here or in person it seems like our revolution today is to find each other and not let ourselves be mediated, you know, by all the, you know, disintermediating intimacies. We have this techno feudalism that disintermediates intimacy at its very core. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Very much appreciate.
Yeah.
And Andrew, thank you so much for making it happen.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks to the conspiratorial forces of the universe.
Right.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Andrew.
Good luck, Mark. I know there's a lot on your plate. So.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Lots of love. Thanks so much for coming to Parallax, and hope we do it again sometime.